The Exchange Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, equal housing opportunity.
Enjoy the show.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Our guest today will deliver a stern message at half a dozen stops in New Hampshire this week that money is playing far too large a role in American foreign policy. We're talking this hour with retired Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson. He served three decades in the U.S. Army, capping his public career as Chief of Staff to former Secretary of State Colin Powell. It was a critical time, with the country still raw and shocked after 9/11, and when the Bush administration was making the case to go to war against Iraq. Wilkerson and others helped Powell shape his now infamous presentation to the United Nations, where Powell revealed the supposed proof that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. It's a role Colonel Wilkerson now deeply regrets, and we'll talk about that past, as well as his view on the U.S. role in the Mideast's future, as our military reengages there to fight the so-called Islamic State, or ISIS. Lawrence Wilkerson will be visiting several communities over the next few days, including Durham, Portsmouth, Concord, and Plymouth. For more information, go to our website, nhpr.org. He's in our studios this morning. And Colonel Wilkerson, thanks for your time. It's nice to meet you.
It's good to be in New Hampshire.
You can also join our conversation. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, the number, 1-800-892-6477. So I'm going to start off our conversation, Colonel Wilkerson, with a cliche, pardon me, the old saying that those who don't learn their history are doomed to repeat it. As somebody who was involved in making this case to go to war against Iraq, what did you learn?
I learned that what you just said is absolutely true, and it's certainly true with what we call fateful decisions, presidents who send young men and young women to die for state purposes, and something we often forget, to kill others for state purposes, often make the same mistakes repeatedly. As we were approaching Iraq in the late fall of 2002, we had the UN Security Council Resolution 1441, 15-0 vote for inspectors to go back in. And Powell and I and others at State were really euphoric about that victory. We were talking with each other about what it would be like if we failed and we went to war. And the Vietnam analogy was right there in front of us, not simply because we'd lived through it, but because it was instructive. It was insightful as to what not to do when using the military instrument. And then what did we do? We walked right into something that approximated Vietnam with as illegitimate and stupid and even ignorant decision-making as occurred with respect to Vietnam. So your point is well taken.
Well, and you and Colin Powell both served in Vietnam,
yes.
Correct? And I have read that Colin Powell was deeply, deeply shaped by his experience there, sort of a dovish warrior, if you could put it that way.
The reluctant warrior.
The reluctant warrior, yeah.
That's the phrase that stuck to him. And not because he wasn't of a mind that if the president wanted to use the military instrument, he would, and he would do so faithfully, but because it should be the last resort. Everything else, political, economic, cultural, informational, social, everything you've got in your toolbox with respect to power should be used before you send young men and women to die.
So there you guys are, reluctant warriors, maybe the two of you, and yet you shaped this presentation to the United Nations. I remember watching it. We all remember watching it. It was very convincing. Just walk us through that, if you could, Colonel Wilkerson. You know, how did that happen? How'd you get from A to B there?
Yeah, I've watched it from the floor of the UN Security Council. And As a matter of fact, looking directly at Secretary Powell and George Tenet, the director of Central Intelligence, and knowing that what I'd spent the last 7 days and nights with very little sleep and my team too doing was put together circumstantial evidence that as I watched it for the very first time in its whole at the UN Security Council, wasn't very convincing. And so later, when I had walked out into the bracing February air in New York and kind of refreshed myself a little bit, I got to thinking, why was I being told by everyone at the end of the presentation, and then later it'd be confirmed by polls, that it had been so successful? And I realized there was one reason. It was Colin Powell giving the presentation. And even then, I began to expect that we had been more or less used by an administration that was intent on going to war and put its best, most faithful, loyal servant forward. Mother Teresa was the only person in polling that had a higher rating than Powell. She was about 77 and he was about 75. So they put their best figure forward in order to corroborate what I think increasingly, as I've studied it since, many of them knew was a fabricated case for WMD in Iraq.
Many have said, as you just said, that Colin Powell was the perfect man to deliver this message to the United Nations because, as you said, he was so trusted, respected by people on both sides of the aisle. I remember there was a draft Powell presidential movement here in New Hampshire that attracted Republicans and Democrats. A couple more questions for you on this since you raised it, Colonel Wilkerson. Did Secretary of State Powell have doubts as he got up there before the United Nations, or was he convinced?
He had doubts. There's no question about it. So did I, and so did many at State and many elsewhere in the government. The doubts, however, were subject to the director of Central Intelligence, George Tenet, and his deputy, John McLaughlin, who were speaking for the 16 different $100 billion intelligence apparatus marshaled by the United States, as well as for Israel, France, Britain, Germany, Russia, and others with whom we collaborated who also believed, maybe not in the particulars, but in the generals, that Saddam still had weapons of mass destruction. So it's hard as a single individual, even as the premier minister in our government, if you will, to stand up against that apparatus when it's arrayed completely and dynamically against you, as Mr. Tenet was. And I'll say this on your radio. I think Mr. Tenet lied to the Secretary of State on some very key issues, most formidably, most powerfully, about the connections, supposed connections, between Saddam Hussein and his intelligence service and al-Qaeda, even to the extent that Mr. Tenet told the Secretary that there was formidable connections between them, that the Mukhabarat, the secret police in Iraq, were training al-Qaeda operatives in how to use chemical and biological weapons. That was a patent lie. And I think Mr. Tenet knew it at the time.
Why would Mr. Tenet do that, lie to Colin Powell?
This is what I teach. Why do people do these things? It involves power orchestrated at the peak levels of that power. It involves the corruption of power. It involves personal bureaucratic power. It involves a president who puts his hand around a DCI's neck and squeezes his neck and says, "Ha-ha, you're my bud now." And Mr. Tenet knows that if he's going to be the president's bud, if he's going to be in the Oval Office every day, Bill Clinton wouldn't even let his DCI in the office with
DCI's
him.
DCI's Director of Central Intelligence.
Yeah. Sure. Director of the CIA and Director of Central Intelligence at that time. It involves becoming so close to your president, to your first client, as Mr. Tenet used to call George W. Bush, that you lose perspective and you will do almost anything to maintain that closeness, to maintain that power, to include lying.
So you're serving more the president than the public.
You're serving the first
client. And the Constitution.
Exactly. And I teach my students, and they look in some dismay sometimes at the case studies we go through, Nixon in Chile, for example, Eisenhower and Mossadegh in Iran in 53, Jacobo Arbenz, whom we overthrew in Guatemala in 54 and so forth. And they can't believe that their country has been involved in these sort of machinations, these sort of secret, undemocratic operations. And yet we have been. Ronald Reagan conducted 59 covert operations in his 8 years, along with Bill Casey, his director of the CIA. My students find it difficult to believe that their country is spending their dollars in doing some of these nefarious things. And by the way, it hasn't stopped.
Well, I'd love to ask you about Iraq as a case study, some of the other case studies, and looking now at the current situation, fighting ISIS and so forth. Let me also invite our listeners to join us, Colonel Wilkerson. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Today in the exchange, we're talking with retired Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson. As we've been hearing, he is former chief of staff to Colin Powell at the time the buildup to the Iraq war was happening. Today, he teaches national security to college students and using this and many other instances as case studies in national security. And some of the mistakes that are made, lies that are told, as he's telling us today on the exchange. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Just remembering back to that time, Colonel Wilkerson, the years right after 9/11 were very scary. Nobody knew when the next shoe was going to drop. I mean, it's important to remember just what the time was like. I mean, we had no idea if somebody was going to drop a nuclear bomb on us, or, you know, Al-Qaeda used to make threats that we're going to fly hundreds of planes across America and crash into hundreds of buildings. And it was a very scary time. Saddam Hussein had used chemical weapons on his own people and on the Iranians. So it wasn't completely outside the pale that he might do this again.
Not at all. And I think that was the reason Colin Powell ultimately agreed with the president that the war should happen. The two warnings that he gave the president became very prescient, though. One was, Mr. President, you really are bad in your timing. And what he meant by that, because we knew, we'd been chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and I was his special assistant, when we cut the military budget, giving the people a peace dividend at the end of the Cold War by some 25%. Then Bill Clinton had come in. We served Bill Clinton in his first year, and we cut under Les Aspin, then Secretary of Defense, another 3-4%. So we knew we couldn't do two wars simultaneously and do justice to both of them. So he told the president, your timing is not good.
We're already engaged in Afghanistan.
We're already engaged, and you're going to ignore Afghanistan, which is exactly what we turned out to do. And the second thing he warned him of was legitimacy. He said, Mr. President, you do not have legitimacy. Germany's not with you. One of your foremost allies thinks you're dead wrong. France is not with you. One of your foremost allies. Again, the only country that's with you of consequence is the United Kingdom. So those were the warnings he gave him.
But so he delivered those warnings.
He delivered those warnings in an over-hour briefing to the president. But ultimately, he was the Secretary of State and the president was the elected president. So when the president said, we're going to do it, and incidentally, the president didn't say we're going to do it. It just happened. There is no national security decision document that codifies the decision to go to war with Iraq. We just did it.
That raises a whole bunch of other questions.
Doesn't
that I've
it?
Got for you. You know, the president, the Congress, the role of declaring war, who really does it, who really should do it. And we'll take your calls. We'll talk about that after a break and hear from you as well. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. We'll be right back. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, Lawrence Wilkerson is here, retired colonel, former chief of staff to Colin Powell. Today, a college professor who looks at national security issues. As we've been hearing, Colonel Wilkerson was involved in the decision-making leading up to the Iraq war. He's talking about some of the doubts that he and then Secretary of State Colin Powell had, how the decision was made ultimately to go to war anyway. You can join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter if you'd like. And Colonel Wilkerson, before we go to our listeners, a couple more questions for you, please. You mentioned earlier about the doubts that you and Secretary of State Powell had, but how this whole sort of George Tenet, the CIA director, got close, maybe too close to the president, felt like he was serving the president first, the people second. What about you and Secretary Powell? I mean, could you guys have spoken up more, behaved differently, been less concerned with those who were over you and ultimately kind of blown the whistle?
There's always that opportunity for any government servant, no matter what level you're at. I think the general consensus, if you will, in Washington, And certainly mine and Powell's view was that resignation did, or protesting did one thing. It got you fired or resigned, and it lasted about a week, even if you were someone like Colin Powell. And then someone would come in who was more compliant to the decision being made, and the government would move right on and do it anyway. Had I resigned, it would have been like a pebble falling into the middle of the Pacific Ocean. Powell would have obviously had more impact, but I agree with that assessment that it probably would not have stopped this administration from going to war. And let me add, the same set of circumstances for different reasons and with slightly different cast of characters is now taking place in Washington with regard to Iran. So we're looking at the possibility of not just three wars over the last 14 years, Afghanistan, Iraq, and the global war on terror, but a fourth war in Southwest Asia with Iran, 75 million strong, 51% Persian, militarily, demographically, national cohesion-wise, the hegemon in the Gulf, a real power. I studied fighting the Russians in Iran when I was a military officer. And let me tell you, Alexander the Great almost died in Iran. That is not some place you want to fight a war. You're going to have 500,000 troops, 10 years, $2 trillion. And at the end, if you like Iraq, you'll love Iran. And yet we are marching down that very sure pathway today, principally because of some Democrats and a lot of Republicans, my political party, who are bound and determined to derail the current set of negotiations going on with that country.
How do you see us marching down that path? We've all read a lot about the nuclear deal, and I want to ask you a couple questions about that, but how do you see people marching down that path?
There are three stark alternatives in this chess game. One is containment, and that is that we keep the sanctions and we try to contain Iran. Those sanctions will fall apart immediately upon Iran assuming that we've taken up that posture, which would be right after negotiations ending. The second option is the negotiations and a diplomatic solution to this, one that we can trust but verify. The third one, and the one we're going to go to if the first two fail, is war. And people like Marco Rubio or Tom Cotton talking about bombing and about that being the end of it just simply don't understand what they're talking about, because our own intelligence community says if we bomb, they'll make a decision. As the North Koreans did, they'll go deep underground and they will make a decision to make a nuclear weapon, and they will succeed in doing so. So how do you stop that? There's only one way. It's invasion. It's a long, protracted war with a country three times the size of Iraq in terms of population and in terms of terrain. And it's an outcome not unlike that in Iraq when you get through, with every GI, every Marine, every soldier, every airman, every sailor walking around with a red bullseye on their back for however long we are there. Everyone will want to kill them.
So are you saying that just like weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, some people are using the nuclear issue in Iran to drag the United States into war there?
They are. And they're just like in Iraq, their motivations are multiple. There are many different motivations. In Iraq, it was oil. It was Israel. It was showing American power post 9/11. In Iran, it's much of the same. It's lots of reasons for different people. Principal reason for many of the Democrats who are trying, it seems like Chuck Schumer of New York, to derail negotiations is Israel. They think the security of Israel is dependent on our taking Iran out, so to speak. I think the security of Israel is dependent on long-term our actually coming to a modus vivendi with Iran and stabilizing the region. Look at Iran for a moment. It is the most stable country in the region. It is also the most powerful country in the region. And this will surprise some of your listeners, I'm sure. It probably has more democratic tendencies and democratic operations going on than any of the other so-called allies other than Israel in the region. Saudi Arabia is a monarchy, a very draconian monarchy that suppresses its minority Shia and so forth. And yet we're cheek and jowl with Saudi Arabia. Here's a country that is the natural hegemon in the Gulf. We used it as such for 25 years when the Shah was in charge, from 53 to 79. It's naturally the hegemon. We need better relations with it. We're not going to solve Afghanistan. We're not going to solve Iraq, Syria, all the problems in the region unless Iran is helping us solve them.
Well, and that gets to all the complexities and the shifting alliances and the battle against ISIS. And I definitely want to ask you about that, Colonel Wilkerson. But one more question just about this idea that you say some in Congress are marching us on a path to war with Iran. Do you think that the American public would stand for that? People seem, you know, so tired of our long, expensive engagement in the Middle East.
I hope you're right. I hope you're right. I saw what the American public did with Congress. I was in the Congress, literally, on the floor of the Senate when the issue of Syria and bombing Syria came up, and I saw the so-called cards and letters pour into Congress, don't do this, don't do this. And I watched the Congress actually shift because of that input. I hope you're right, but I also see, as I go across the country, I see Americans very concerned about what they think is the premier issue, and that is nuclear weapons in the hands of Iran, the mad mullahs, some of them will say, and Israel's security. What I try to assure them of is they're wrong in terms of Israel's long-term security. It's better assured by a reasonable relationship with Iran rather than a war with Iran.
So just like WMD, nukes, same thing.
Yes.
Same story, different day.
Yes.
Here's an email that just came in from Peter in Peterborough. He says, my question is related to Iraq and WMD. Please clarify what UN Security Council resolutions were in place when Colin Powell made his famous speech. Peter says, I thought the UN had, on several occasions, confirmed WMD with qualified inspections. Peter, thanks for the question. There's a lot of history there that, you know, that some of us have forgotten.
Yeah, there is. And let's face it, Norm Schwarzkopf in 1991 only signed a ceasefire agreement in the desert with Saddam Hussein. So the first war actually had not ended. It was just ceased fire. And we had no-fly zones with the French, British, and us in the north and south. The French fell off. We had the British and us as we went to war again. It's a good question. There were 16 or 17 UN Security Council resolutions in some way or another censuring Iran or calling Iraq to do certain things. And that was one of the reasons that Powell could justify going to war, because the UN was being made to look foolish with Saddam violating all these resolutions. The real resolution of note here, though, is the one 1441 in November of 2002, which essentially said on the behalf of the UN, let's put the inspectors back in. Saddam Hussein will agree. He has agreed. Let's put him back in and let's see what we can find. And Hans Blix and others were going to go in and do that. Then Vice President Cheney, this was Bush and Powell and Condi Rice together. Vice President Cheney goes to the VFW and gives a speech that is totally the opposite of that. That speech was not cleared by the president. It was not cleared by Secretary Powell. It was not cleared by anyone, as far as I know, other than Secretary Cheney's office. That speech set the war tone immediately after 1441 was unanimously voted. So the inspectors immediately knew that, hey, even though we're back in, even though we've got the mandate, the United States is ratcheting up for war. And as a consequence, it happened.
So were the inspections just kind of I don't know how to put it, a temporary cover while the administration made its plans?
Looking back on it, and as my students analyze the case study, that's the conclusion they come to, although I hesitate to say the president knew that. I think Dick Cheney knew that, because Dick Cheney was running national security at that point. It takes President Bush all the way to November 2006 when he fires Secretary Rumsfeld before he figures out what Vice President Cheney is doing to him and isolates him. Read Peter Baker's new book, New York Times reporter, about how Cheney is the only one voting for war with Iran later on in the administration. And the president pretty much puts Cheney in a closet with regard to national security. But at that particular point, Cheney was more or less driving the train to war.
Well, and Dick Cheney and to some extent Rumsfeld have sort of become the poster children, you know, those kind of held up as the guys who dragged the country to war. But, you know, at some level, Colonel Wilkerson, have they become scapegoats for a broader responsibility from other government officials, from the press, from the military establishment, from the Joint Chiefs of Staff?
No question.
It's easy to sort of keep pointing the finger at them.
You left one out, the American people. And that's the biggest one. My students are constantly pointing out the fact that if the American people aren't objecting, if the American people aren't weighing in, as they did, for example, with Syria and the potential for bombing Syria, then the president is free to do whatever he wants to. And so are all these other people. However they may manipulate the power, they're free to do it. If the American people are so apathetic that they just go along, That's what's going to happen.
Or, and I'll give you a chance to beat up on the press here, press gives them a story that says, yeah, Saddam Hussein,
Judy Miller in the New York Times. Right. Judy Miller was, and Michael Gordon was her complicit compatriot there for a while, were actually mouthpieces for the administration. Scooter Libby and the vice president's office would leak to the New York Times. The New York Times would then print the story, oh, my God, Saddam Hussein has weapons of mass destruction, including an active nuclear program. And then the vice president would go on Tim Russert's Meet the Press and say, even the New York Times says. And he's the one who gave the information.
So it's a feedback loop.
Yes, exactly. Very, very astute bureaucratic maneuver, but nonetheless not in the interest of the country.
And Judy Miller actually recently published her biography saying, look, I was just reporting what my sources told me.
Yeah.
So
Judy's a little bit naive, or she's conniving there, because she knew who her sources were and she knew what she was doing.
Let's go back to our listeners. Again, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. By the way, Peter, thank you for that email. Let's go to Nashua, where Tom is on the line. Hi, Tom. Go ahead.
Hi, how you doing? I apologize if this isn't really a relevant thing to bring up, but I'm wondering if maybe any lessons we learned from Iraq about transparency could be applied to our current mass surveillance apparatus, and what your guest thinks about that.
The mass surveillance, the concerns over the NSA spying on average American phone calls. Yeah, thanks a lot. It's a good question, Tom. Thank you.
Excellent question. I belong to something called the Constitution Project in Washington, and we work with the Congress and other government agencies trying to do something about this. We've been briefed on the NSA, the FISA courts. We've been briefed on warrantless searches, Bill of Rights Amendment 4, for example, freedom of speech, warrantless searches, those sorts of things. And frankly, I've come away from this experience very dismayed in what the Congress has allowed to happen, largely under the Patriot Act and under the FISA Amendments Act, and what it's done to aid and abet the usurpation, the taking away from American citizens of their rights to privacy. We need to get out of this state. It's temporarily explicable because of 9/11, but it's no longer explicable. And yet it's still going on. And the bureaucracy that's doing this is growing and growing because people are heavily invested in it now and making money off of it. So that's an excellent question.
Well, and FISA is Foreign Intelligence Surveillance.
Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court.
Which basically gives...
It says that if you're going to do something that's untoward, you've got to go to this secret court and get it blessed. Well, let me tell you what the secret court does. 99.9% of the time, it rubber stamps the government's request. It's all in secret. There's no one there for advocacy purposes or anything else. It just says, okay, go ahead and do it.
Okay, so you said, hey, maybe after 9/11, this was perhaps explicable, but it no longer is. What about the argument, Colonel Wilkerson? I wonder what you think, that, you know, there's concerns that there may be militants within our midst, so to speak, you know, people who are going to, well, do a Boston Marathon type bombing. So maybe we, I'm just putting this out there, maybe we do still need to be listening in.
Those who will surrender their liberty for a little more security deserve neither. That's Benjamin Franklin. And I could quote Hamilton, Madison, and a number of others, too, whom I think are very smart men. This is not something you want to do against a risk, as the Cato Institute pointed out recently in a very graphic profile, that is about the risk of a lightning strike in terms of your being killed. We are spending trillions of dollars investing all kinds of effort into usurpation of privacy, of all the civil liberties that we enjoy, for a threat that has the potential of a lightning strike to kill one of us. That's preposterous. It's preposterous. And now we have so many people invested in, as Powell said the other day, this terrorist industrial complex, that it has become an entity in itself. People are making money off this complex, and that just makes it grow and breed like Topsy. Now, I will be the first to point out that if a weapon of mass destruction like a nuclear one, a small-yield nuclear weapon, were to fall into terrorist hands, we've got a whole different proposition. You explode one of those in Washington or Chicago or New York, probably be New York or Washington, governance and financial center, You got a new problem on your hand. My army is training for, your army is training for martial law in that respect. They're doing exercises in connection with that. We might arguably lose our democracy after something like that happens, because the people will be then so frightened and so scared that you'll be able to do almost anything if you're president. That's a scary set of circumstances, and I hope it doesn't come about. But it is a factor that one has to consider if one's sitting in the Oval Office, and do everything to try and prevent. Again, coming back to the negotiations with Iran, I think these are very important in that regard. It's very important to bring Iran into the fold, so to speak, to get it out of the terrorism business, to get it out of the business of clandestine operations that are not in the interest of anyone in the West. And I think you don't do that by bombing them. You do that by growing them up, as we're doing with China, to be a responsible stakeholder in their region and in the world.
Well, in a minute, I want to follow up on your terrorist industrial complex, harkening back to Eisenhower's military industrial complex. But let's go to Sharon in Dover first. Sharon, go ahead. You're on the exchange with Colonel Wilkerson.
Hi. First of all, I want to say I agree with everything you're saying, Colonel Wilkerson, except I want to point out that there was a substantial anti-war for Iraq movement. I was part of it, the Seacoast Peace Response, and we were just one of a network, and we vehemently opposed the Iraq war, and we were called anti-patriotic. So there were a lot of people that I knew who were dead set against that war. And I also want to make the point that in addition to Cheney, who we all know manipulated the data about weapons of mass destruction, the press, I feel, played a big part in that war. I remember watching the nightly news, and every time I watched it, it said countdown to Iraq, as if it was a fake plea, as if the press had already decided that this was an accomplished fact.
Well, and Sharon, thank you for calling in. And we did talk about the press a minute ago, but she's right. I remember the anti-war demonstrations. They were big.
Yes. I was in London and saw the biggest anti-war demonstration probably in the world. There were over 1.5 million people in the streets of London. And when I came back to Washington, duly reported. You've got a good point about the media. The media was complicit. The media is complicit in what's happening with regard to Iran today.
I got to cut you off there, Colonel Wilkerson. Thank you so much, Sharon. We'll be right back. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, Lawrence Wilkerson is here. He's on a trip of several days to New Hampshire. If you want more information about his itinerary, you can go to our website, nhpr.org. Colonel Wilkerson was former chief of staff to Colin Powell during that critical time of the build-up to the Iraq War. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at that, but also applying it to what we're seeing now in terms of U.S. policy in the Middle East. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Here's a question for you, Colonel Wilkerson, before we go back to our listeners. What is the American public's expectation when it comes to what our foreign policy can achieve in the Middle East? It's so complicated. All the rivalries and Sunni versus Shia versus Kurd. There's probably others that I'm forgetting. What are the public's expectations that we can figure this out?
I would recommend reading Richard Haass, currently the president of Council on Foreign Relations and my old boss at the State Department, my initial boss, Ambassador Haass, article in Foreign Affairs, The Unraveling. What's happening is we're seeing the results of the disappearance of the two powers in the world, the Soviet Union and the United States, and we're seeing the inchoate response, and I would say of both Putin and Obama, Bush before them and Yeltsin before Putin, to this unraveling and the almost helplessness before it. Putin's reacting to it with a sort of entrenchment, and don't come bother me, I'll beat you up if you do. If you're in Chechnya, I'm going to control you, and if you come to Moscow, I'll kill you and all your brothers. We're reacting to it more or less in the Susan Rice, Samantha Power vogue of, oh, all this terrible stuff, we've got to do something about it, we've got to help. And yet we've got a president who is war-weary along with the American public and not eager to go help, at least not with boots on the ground. So we've got a standoff right now between what were the powers and what is developing in the world, which is inevitable because the powers of the great ones are diminishing, with the exception of China growing, Germany growing, Brazil growing, and the rest of the world becoming stateless, as Richard says in this article. So many organizations out there want to kill people, want to gain power for various reasons, and they're stateless. They're not the kind of Westphalian entities that you can deal with. There so far has not been a strategy in Moscow or Washington or in Berlin, in Paris or London, or in Tokyo or in Beijing to deal with this. And it is going to be the future in this century as the G8, the G7, the G20, whoever, the UN, new institutions get their act together and figure out how to handle this. But I'll guarantee you one thing. The United States will go bankrupt morally and physically if it tries to do it alone.
Because we're just so deeply engaged in so many places
already. We're like an empire frittering away its powers on its periphery. And you don't need to go back very far to study this. You could go back to Britain to see what happened to Britain. You have to husband your resources, and most of all, you have to turn away from hard power. You keep your military, your hard power dry, as it were, your powder dry, and you keep it ready. But you've got to do something other than use your hard power. You've got to use your developmental power, your political power, your diplomatic power. That's why I think Iran is so important in setting this precedent of handling what many people think is a hard power problem with soft power.
Well, speaking of hard power versus soft power and President Obama's reluctance to put American boots on the ground, Iraq's prime minister is in D.C. this week, meeting with President Obama, meeting with a lot of folks, asking the president for more help. Obama has pledged, I think it was $200 million in humanitarian assistance. But the Iraqi prime minister says we need more than that. We need tanks. We need heavy equipment. Should we give it to him?
I think basically as a military professional, that's mostly hogwash, what's coming from the Iraqi prime minister. The Iraqis have adequate weaponry, adequate forces right now if they had the guts, the intestinal fortitude, the courage, the organization, the leadership to use that to defeat what is really a very small element of opposition in their vast country tomorrow morning if they would just use it.
That's pretty harsh, Colonel Wilkerson.
It is harsh.
I was looking at some of the news yesterday and going to some of the video about, you know, Ramadi being under siege from ISIS and you know, all these cities being taken by these people who seem quite ruthless and will behead you, you know, in a New York minute, thank you very much.
And who at best number maybe 20,000, at the outside 30,000. The Iraqi armed forces are over 100,000. This is just not something that a military man looks at and says, wow, this is a real significant threat. This is not a significant threat. The media has made them seem a significant threat, and they've exploited the media to do that by cutting people's throats and so forth. But this is not a threat that's existential to anyone in the region unless they let it be. And the Iraqis seem to be bound and determined to let it be and to let the United States and others do the heavy lifting rather than doing it themselves. And my point is you're never going to get a state that's meaningful in a country called Iraq, unless they can defend themselves. Now, air power and other assets are they can be helpful. They have been helpful. What's happening right now is air power has driven these forces into urban areas, as you just stated, because they can't stand it. They're being killed when they come out of those urban areas. We won't bomb the urban areas because we have too much collateral damage.
Sure.
So now it's up to the Iraqis to go into those urban areas and take the casualties necessary to eliminate these people, or simply cordon them off and let them die. But you've got to do something, and it's got to be the native forces that do it. It can't be outside forces. Otherwise, we'll be there forever.
Wow. Well, I could probably ask you six more questions on that because it's a heartbreaking situation.
It is.
There.
And Iraqis tell me now that they were better off under Saddam Hussein. Women tell me they were better off. Women tell me they had more rights. Women tell me they had more freedom. Women tell me they had more access to jobs and education under Saddam Hussein. This is what we did. We didn't just destroy the balance of power in the Gulf and therefore produce what we're seeing now. We hurt Iraq's people.
Let's go back to our listeners, see what they think. And Kevin is in Bedford. Hi, Kevin. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for calling in.
Yes, good morning. Long-time listener, and I call in periodically. First, kudos to NHPR for getting a guest of this caliber. Welcome to the Colonel. Well, I love your no BS. I agree with almost everything you've said. The stuff I don't agree with, I probably don't have enough knowledge of. But I'm just curious. I've seen in social media, across Facebook, on some of these Patriot sites, that they have found some, small may it be, but some materials of mass, weapon of mass destruction in Iraq upon further review in the last 6 months to a year. And, of course, the article I saw was, oh, of course the media wouldn't report it. And have you heard or seen anything to that? I'll take the answer off air. And also, people listen to what he's saying about the fortitude. The Iraqis got to step it up, and they got to own it. I love it. Welcome to New Hampshire. Hope you come back.
Thanks, Kevin, for the call. Go ahead, Colonel Wilkerson.
Yeah, thanks for your question. Yes, that has come out, and what's been determined by those who are experts in the area is that these were munitions that probably even Saddam Hussein didn't remember. Maybe his generals did, but they were buried out in the desert. They're so old that they're almost unusable. But here's an ancillary thought for you. In discovering these weapons and in dealing with them, we have some people who've been injured. And right now we're trying to hide that fact, and we're trying not to give these people benefits and hospitalization and so forth. So this is a combination of eras, if you will, that bespeaks how this bureaucracy works, especially in terms of trying to hide things that come up that aren't in line with what it wants to happen.
Well, we've talked a lot about the bureaucracy and, you know, how there were doubts about going into war in Iraq, but people at the top wanted to, so there we were. Is there a prescription for a better way, Colonel Wilkerson?
I think there is. I think it begins institutionally, but it ends, and far more importantly, with people. Institutionally, we need to stop this business of centralized decision-making in the White House. Look at what President Obama's done, for example. Henry Kissinger had about 40 people on his NSC staff. President Obama has 350-plus. What we've done is pulled all decision-making on critical issues, especially financial, economic, and national security, into the White House. And we've disenfranchised the cabinet. We simply don't have bureaucrats who are allowed to do their job anymore. Often they're implementing decisions they had no input into whatsoever because they're made in the White House. So that's the institutional change that needs to take place. More important than that is the people change that needs to take place. We are sending all of our bright people who are of consequence from all the Ivy Leagues, from other schools around the country who produce these kinds of people, largely to Wall Street, to Goldman Sachs, to Citibank, and so forth, not to the federal government. We are putting mediocre people in the federal government. Now, I'm not disparaging the professional services, the Foreign Service, the National Security Agency, and so forth. What I'm doing is telling the truth. The best people in America are not going into public service anymore. They're not going into government. You've got to get good people, and at the tip of that, you've got to have some people to vote for. You got to have some people. Think about it for a moment. We may vote for, in 2016, two dynasty products, Hillary Clinton on the one side and Jeb Bush on the other. This is the best we can do with a nation of 330 million people.
So should we pay civil servants more?
That's one of the problems, is they don't get paid enough. But another problem is it's become, as we've just discussed here, it's become something young, dynamic, energetic people don't want to do.
And why is that?
They see what's happening. And
they get cynical about some of the—
They grow cynical about it. And they don't want to touch it with a 10-foot pole.
Well, and you're teaching classes, and you told us earlier that your college students can't believe some of the stuff that's gone on. How do you pair that message together of, yeah, look at all the stuff that's gone on. It's not good. The consequences have been devastating in some instances. And by the way, you should go work for the federal government.
Well, let me give you an anecdote. Young lady comes in to see me. She's a 4-4 in Arabic, which means she speaks and writes it like a native almost.
Wow.
She comes in and she says very tentatively, Professor, I've got an offer from the National Security Agency. What do you think? What other offers do you have? Deloitte Touche, Goldman, and Beltway Bandit that does a lot of intelligence work,
consulting
all of whom
firms.
Were offering her over $100,000 starting salary. NSA at best probably $45,000-$50,000. I said, go into the NSA. She said, you surprised me. Why would you say that? I said, because unless we get good people like you in the National Security Agency, how will we ever change it? That's my answer.
Let's take another call. Ron's in Manchester. Hi, Ron. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi, Laura. Hi, Colonel. Thank you for your service to the Republic. I just wanted to make a quick comment about, I appreciate everything you're saying. You know, we can't afford to stop ignoring the facts, but we live in a new country now where facts are whatever you want them to be. I encounter people every day who insist that Iraq indeed did have weapons of mass destruction. And no amount of, like, look, experts, they all say that they didn't. And I think it's just the fractured media landscape we live in now where you can encapsulate yourself in an echo chamber that tells you what you want to hear, what you already believe, and it makes it really hard for people like you to present the facts and say, hey, look, we're not going to live much longer as a republic if we don't start, you know, facing the hard facts that we don't like.
Because people just don't believe the facts anymore. They say, well, those aren't my facts.
Well, what are facts?
Yeah.
We don't have Walter Cronkite telling us as a country what the facts are anymore. We don't have a single media narrative anymore. You listen to whatever you want to listen to, and unfortunately, most people listen to the voices that reinforce what they already believe.
Okay, Ron, thank you very much for calling in.
Yeah, Ron, you're absolutely right. I was recently in Oklahoma, the only state where every single precinct voted for Mitt Romney, a red state par excellence, and yet I found there at a Rotary Club meeting, second largest Rotary in America, and at various dinners and lunches, I found a deep concern about physical matters and about the blood, sweat, and tears of America's service members. And I tried to talk about that in the sense of how the media has been utterly irresponsible in protecting all of that. I think what my students have pointed out to me, though, is there is a nascent, it's very, very bifurcated, inchoate right now, but a nascent effort growing on the internet. And you have to be very careful about how you parse it. But you can find the truth on the internet. You can find facts on the internet. My students, here's another anecdote. My students will tell me without equivocation that their main sources of news were Stephen Colbert and The Daily Show. That's where they got most of their news. And frankly, I had to respond to them by saying, yes, as a matter of fact, in that political satire is probably more fact and truth than you're going to find in any major leading media, visual, or print.
Ouch.
That's a heck of a statement to make. But I also told them if they read some of the other things, like the New York Times or whatever, they might understand the jokes better because, like, knowing the sexual mores of Elizabethan England increases your appreciation of Shakespeare's plays, especially the comedies. Knowing what the print media, at least that leading print media, is saying would make you appreciate Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert's jokes better, and increasingly John Oliver on HBO's jokes better. But it is a statement of what the Fourth Estate has failed to do in our democracy, that my students, these bright young men and women, going up to inherit the future of our country, are listening to that rather than reading newspapers and watching cable television.
It's almost like you're saying, though, you don't blame them.
I don't, given the product that they have to look at. Your caller is absolutely, Ron, was it? Absolutely right, that these mainly corporate-influenced media respond to the choir, their choir. They sing to their choir, whether it's Ed Schultz singing to his choir on MSNBC or Sean O'Hannity singing to his choir on Fox or Wolf Blitzer increasingly singing Israel's story on CNN. And I've had some recent run-ins with CNN people being on their shows about this. It's incredible. You are singing to your choir all the time, either individually or corporately. And that's not the way to serve democracy.
Well, you're here in the state, Colonel Wilkerson, for the next couple of days with lots of stops. You got a busy schedule. What's your main message at all these places?
Wake up, America. Wake up and take control of your government.
and consider going into public service.
Yes.
Yourself. Even with all the problems, the warts, everything that you've described this hour.
Especially if you're young and you really want to change the world.
All right. It's been nice to talk to you. I hope you have a good visit here in the state.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
That's Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, retired colonel with 30 years in the U.S. Army, former chief of staff to Colin Powell. Again, if you want to take a look at his schedule, you can go to our website, nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. The senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Faith Meixel and Jason Moon. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.